This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Well, welcome back, everybody. I'm sure you all went very far, as did I. I promise this is your last session with me today, though I'm back on tomorrow morning. I'm here with Jessa Jackley, who's the founder of Kiva.org, co-founder, which was, and it's done a lot of other stuff which we're going to get to, but I just want to know, just so we know what level of depth to go into, how many people here know what Kiva is? Okay. That's great. All right. So we have some familiarity.
Like the fan.
And a fan. Yeah. But why don't you take us back and, you know, tell us the idea behind Kiva and sort of give us the founding story and how it got going.
I grew up with this certain idea of poverty and of my role, my options for kind of getting involved, alleviating poverty or working with the poor. And that was basically, the story was basically as follows. There are people out there that need something, food, clothing, shelter, etc. You, apparently, even as like a five-year-old kid, I learned this lesson, you are not poor. You should help them. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to help. But your job is to basically be this kind of donor type. You swoop in, you give something that you have, usually your money or your time or something that you own, to help out. And then you kind of go on with your life. And you feel, you pat yourself on the back, you feel better about that sort of interaction, and then you go on. It was never, most of the stories that I heard about the poor were from well-intentioned nonprofit organizations, doing projects with my church, but I always felt really bad when I heard these stories because the stories of the poor that I heard were based on sadness and suffering and desperation and hopelessness. And so often, weirdly, the worse I felt, the more I'd kind of get involved, the more I'd sign up to volunteer or give my money or whatever it was. So this cycle sort of continued throughout my life. And then one day, to fast forward through many years of that sort of way of interacting, one day I heard this other story of the poor. And it was through Dr. Muhammad Yunus's story about the Grameen Bank and microfinance in general, financial services and products for the poor, and specifically microlending, small loans for the entrepreneurial poor. The way Dr. Yunus talked about poverty was different than anyone else that I'd, it was different than any other way that I'd heard it talked about before. He talked about individuals who were smart and strong and hardworking, who simply, and we were doing everything right, but we're locked in this cycle of poverty because they simply didn't have access to this little bit of capital, this tiny loan that they needed to sort of change the trajectory of their work and of their productivity, et cetera. So I heard this story of hope and empowerment and dignity kind of for the first time, not this story of desperation and hopelessness and sadness, et cetera. And I felt unlocked. I felt kind of freed to engage with people in a new way. And so after I heard him speak in the fall of 2003 at Stanford, it was a lecture that I just crashed, I moved to East Africa to work there for a while with entrepreneurs that had received $100, actually not even in loan capital, but in grant capital. And this kind of spurred a lot of questions, like what if we stayed in touch with these new friends that I was meeting, goat herders and seamstresses and farmers, small kind of kiosk owners, what if we stayed in touch? And what if me and friends and family, my co-founder Matt, what if we sort of provided them with what they were asking for and what they needed next, which was not a donation, but was a loan, so they could have ownership over their work, over their business, and kind of grow what they were doing. So these kind of questions, what if we stayed in touch? What if we all pooled our funds together and provided them with loan funding? Wouldn't that be fun? Wouldn't that be interesting? And that was the beginning. Those were the beginnings of kind of the seeds of the idea for Kiva. So that was what we ended up doing was in the spring of 2004, we did a pilot round of loans, a little over $3,000 to 7 entrepreneurs in Uganda, very tiny. Over the next 6 months, they were paid. We decided our little idea had worked. maybe 30-some friends and family each pitched in $25 and $50 at a time. So we decided that this thing had worked. In fall of 05, we took the word beta off of the site, launched for real, and that was sort of the official beginning of Kiva. And since that time, the first year Kiva facilitated 500,000 in loans, second year was the total was 15 million, third year was around 40, on and on and on. And today it's I didn't check the last few days, but last I did check it was around 360 million among lenders and entrepreneurs in, you know, total 216 countries.
Yeah.
The fast forward story.
Right, right. And so what's the evidence, or what's like the data that you guys use to sort of evaluate how well this is working? So there's the money going in and then what's going out?
Yeah, so, well, the money does come back too.
Oh, right, also good point.
Kiva's mission is to connect people through lending for poverty alleviation. And I mean, I tend to be kind of touchy-feely about this stuff, but if you look at the mission, there's kind of the what and the how and the why all baked in. So Kiva is about connecting people. The original sort of impetus, as I just explained, was really about connecting with poverty, with the poor in this new way, using lending to do that, and doing it for the purpose, yes, of poverty alleviation, but truthfully also there's sort of this secondary purpose which shows, you know, lenders, everyday people, everyone in this room, a different way to sort of engage and get involved in the world and in writing economic inequalities. So the metrics then are about connection. Yes, it's easy to talk about the numbers. It's easy to talk about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and millions of people being involved. But it really is about the people more than it is about the money. The goal is not let's dump as much money into microfinance as we possibly can. There are other ways to do that. It's not let's, you know, necessarily build this big network of microfinance institutions around the world. That's happened as well, and that's been exciting and interesting in and of itself. But it's really been about individual experiences, connecting people to each other through this very sticky tool for connectivity alone. You know, if you just look at the lender side of things, common sense in the very beginning said that this was a stupid idea to allow lenders to lend at 0%, $25. Like, who would want to do that? People would want a tax break. Some did argue. Or they want a financial return. Why would you let people do this for free, and who's going to do that? but if you just look at that experience, instead of focusing on sort of, oh, this is a loan with no interest, if you look at it as, otherwise, maybe this would have been a donation somewhere, and this is a donation that comes back, that's a lot more attractive to very many people, or it's attractive in addition to the $25 they might give elsewhere, but it's an attractive thing to get involved as a lender and to have that money come back and to be able to kind of repeat that experience again and again and again. And so that's what a lot of people do. So that connection is really what's important. There also is a whole other thread of this conversation, which I'll just make into a 10-second answer, and people can follow up as they would like. But Kiva over the last year just implemented social impact metrics too. So it's not, yes, you can look at just those numbers, how many people are connected, how much money is flowing, all that stuff. But you can see the social impact and the actual poverty alleviation by sort of digging into these different values that Kiva cares about around, the priorities of microfinance institutions. There are a ton of different kinds of microfinance institutions. There are 10,000-ish around the world. Some are for-profit, some are non-profit, some are very much about bottom line and being profitable. Some are about serving even those that are the most expensive and the most difficult to serve. And they're really about more of a social mission. So Kiva's sort of outlined a handful of priorities around championing organizations that are values-based, that do focus on women, that do prioritize education, that sort of thing. So you can see how each loan sort of works. Each entrepreneur whose profile shows up on the site is being served by a microfinance institution that is one of Kiva's partners. In each of those partners, we sort of map and try to explain what those partners are about as best we can to lenders by talking about how risky they are, talking about their history, and definitely talking about whether or not they have sort of this social impact as well in any of those categories. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you talk about Kiva as like a, as a digital platform, like as something that could have been created at that time, but probably not much before then?
Sure. So it's so funny. Most of the things that come to mind are these little anecdotes, but I remember,
yeah, tell them.
I remember, spring of before, my job at that moment in time was to work for a different nonprofit organization. I mean, Kiva didn't really exist yet, but to work for an organization, Village Enterprise Fund, that gave micro grants, these $100 grants to people all throughout Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. And my job was to do an impact survey for them, to, you know, walk around East Africa. It was so fun. And be in a different village every day and interview the folks that had received these $100 grants. And I remember you know, I took a camera and I had a cell phone. And at that point in time, I did research on this like after the fact, but it turns out that Uganda had 80%+ mobile coverage, cell coverage. And it was better than a lot of places in the U.S., different communities that I had been in at least. And so I remember sort of reporting these little anecdotes back to people like, I am talking to you from the, you know, there is no electricity source to be found for miles and miles away. I am in a mud hut and I am on a cell phone to you. This is crazy. I remember having these experiences of connectivity, like super connectivity in unexpected places. And I remember coming back and telling people about this and often people not believing me or being skeptical that that level of connectivity really did exist. And one of the biggest pushbacks in the very beginning, so yeah, imagining the world, remembering the world then, was that this, you know, wouldn't scale, it'd be way too difficult for microfinance institutions to use a digital camera and take a picture of a borrower or to, you know, get online to do anything. And in truth, some, you know, it is a challenge. It has been a challenge for some of the partners, but it's actually, it hasn't been an insurmountable one.
Yeah. It's kind of fascinating too, because in network architecture, right, there's this idea of peer-to-peer. And it's just like, you know, people share across these like very flat networks. And one thing that's so great about it is it does feel, even though there are institutions in between the loaners and the loanees, it still feels, there's that
yeah,
feeling that it's peer-to-peer, right?
Well, and it actually is, your money is actually connected to a real person. So for example, if a lender, you lend to this specific, you know, seamstress in Cambodia, if she defaults on the loan, you will not get your money back. Or, you know, you as a lender take on currency risk and you take on default risk and sometimes currency risk as well, depending. So anyway, you actually are connected directly to that person's success. And it's kind of crazy. There's have you checked out Kiva Zip? There's this very new kind of experimental thing that Kiva's doing over the last year where we've been testing out, I shouldn't say weak. He has been testing out how to lend more directly to individuals through mobile and also through, instead of working with a microfinance institution, just working through like personal sort of representatives, kind of following the trend of allowing people to build a reputation online and, you know, in a different way. Anyway, you should check it out. It's kind of a longer conversation.
Let's move on a little bit from Kiva,
sure,
to what you've done afterwards, because Kiva had all of these elements of sort of crowdfunding and sort of the early social networking tools.
Although weirdly, we didn't talk about it. I don't remember talking about crowdfunding in the first few years of Kiva. Like,
right,
that word wasn't in the mix.
Even though, yeah, now we can look back and apply it, but it's like anachronistic. Yeah. So what did you do after Kiva? You went on, you founded a new company, and,
yes,
and what happened with that?
So imagine my experience. I studied like philosophy and political science undergrad. I never studied business until after Kiva started. I went back to Stanford and got my MBA. So it took me going around the whole world and learning business from goat herders, et cetera, to finally realize, oh, I could be an entrepreneur myself. This would be awesome. So the best, sweetest experience for me throughout getting to be a part of Kiva was realizing that, oh, I might be able to do more things in the world. And I now see what this is like, and I want to try that again. So I started to, after I sort of saw entrepreneurship around the whole world, you know, in dozens and dozens of different countries, I wanted to learn more about entrepreneurship in my own backyard, so to speak. And I started to see this crazy contrast, not just between Silicon Valley and the Great Rift Valley, but Silicon Valley and, you know, and other major hubs and the rest of the country. And I didn't know why Silicon Valley had all these resources to empower entrepreneurs, startups especially, but all kinds, and why the rest of the country, it just seemed like it was so hard for people to get involved to support startups and small businesses that they loved. And we all know Small Business America is important, to say the least. So without going into all the statistics, I started to ask the question, and my co-founder of ProFounder, Dana Moriello, and I started to say, look, what if we built tools to make it easier for people to access capital, investment capital, not just loans, not donations, but like real investments, equity, rev share, however you want to structure it, for their startups. And it turns out that we had to learn all this other stuff that we never really anticipated. So one little side note about Kiva, because what Kiva facilitates is a 0% loan, certainly we had to have conversations with the SEC, but we weren't regulated. Kiva's not it's not regulated by the SEC in the same way that a company that helps others facilitate offerings of securities is regulated. So we had to learn all this crazy stuff about the fact that there are unaccredited and accredited investors in the United States. And there
perhaps
are,
some of you are familiar with this.
Right, so an accredited investor, it's only 13% of the population, but you have to have $1 million in net worth and your house and some other things don't count. You also have had to have made over $200,000 in the last 2 years or $300,000 collectively with your spouse. So it's high net worth individuals. And if you're accredited, it's really easy, truthfully, for you to go invest in whatever you'd like to invest in. And that's great. That's not a bad thing. But what is a bad thing, in my opinion, is the fact that unaccredited investors have a much harder time of it. The laws restrict the number of people that who are unaccredited that can invest in any one deal state to state. So every state is different. And some states just care about, you know, making laws for themselves around unaccredited investor involvement in private offerings of securities or these kind of closed friends and family rounds. But some states, they interact. And so basically, just quick example. So let's say you're starting this wonderful corner cafe and you need 200, it's your dream, right?
My dream.
And you need $200,000 to do it. And you have a list of like 40 friends in 17 different states that you want to raise money from. That should be easy, right? And by the way, thanks to the Jobs Act, it will get easier for sure. Not completely easy, but easier.
This is recently passed legislation.
Yes. I'm sorry, I can go into all this detail. But basically, let's say that's what you wanted to do like 2 years ago. We said, all right, we're going to help you. Here's this like do-it-yourself, one-stop shop to be able to, you list all your friends, list the states, and we will tell you, oh, careful, if you get an investment from that friend in Connecticut, you're only allowed 10 unaccredited investors nationwide. Done. End of story. For the lifetime of your business, not just this round. If you would have gotten somebody from Colorado, we would have said, great, you're allowed, because of what Colorado says, you're allowed up to 500 or 499 unaccredited investors. It's great. So every state had these crazy different rules. So we built this sort of engine, this compliance engine that let you map those and kind of fed you to the right places to fill out paperwork, pay fees, whatever. So we made it as simple as possible. We gave you a pitch generator. We gave you tools to reach out to your community online. And another thing that we did, we sort of pushed boundaries and asked, I think, really good questions around what really is the difference between a private round of securities and a public offering. I mean, they're very different mechanisms. An IPO is obviously way too robust for your corner cafe, but a private offering, the way it's been defined, it seemed a little restrictive. So there's another legal term, friends and family. You're only allowed to include friends and family in certain deals that are private, but no one had really defined whether that meant Twitter followers or Facebook friends or whatever. So we started to ask those questions too. So to wrap this segment up, sorry, long answer. This was 3 years of my life.
Right,
and we
right.
learned all this stuff we never anticipated. But basically, we started ProFounder to solve this problem of you raising that money that you wanted from this community that exists out there that wants to support you but would rather invest than just give you money. Seems like something that should be able to happen. So we built the tools to do that. We ended up, the company's already going through its whole life cycle. We ended up winding it down after two rounds of funding for a variety of reasons. But basically, we started to get involved in crafting the Jobs Act, Title IV specifically, the crowdfunding part of the Jobs Act that passed last March. And we saw that if this were to happen in the world, things were going to change and that it might take a while. And so as an entrepreneur, I made the call to basically not raise a huge Series A round and then just wait for the SEC to make its rules so that we could get going again, but to do some other things and focus on my family as well. I have one-year-old twins and they were about to arrive. And so I thought it might be also a good time to focus on them. So that's kind of the story of ProFounder.
Right.
That was a really long answer, but are you happy with that?
I was happy with it. Yeah. Okay.
I want to do quality control with my answers.
Yes, yes.
You feeling fine
about that? Was
that?
Good.
Okay. All right. You might just want to say you have 30 seconds, go. Or like
okay,
you have 2 minutes,
enough.
Go. Okay.
Fair enough. Okay, you have 30 seconds.
Okay.
If we have, so the investor accreditation, right, was like
right.
put in to protect people who, you know, in 1900 would like invest in some mining operation, right?
Oh, it's 1930. It's not that old, yeah.
Well, but I mean, you know, 80 years old or whatever, right. to like protect small-time investors, right?
Widows and orphans is often quoted, like, we don't want the widows and orphans to lose all their money. There's also, by the way, this doesn't count. It's not the 30 seconds because you didn't ask your question yet. But there's also sophisticated and unsophisticated investors. It's crazy. There's some crazy, crazy ways of categorizing people.
Okay. So what would you say would be like the right kind of protections to put in place for people versus like
Okay, I'm watching. So I think the information disclosure requirements make a lot of sense. So transparency sort of fixes a lot of these or addresses a lot of these concerns. I think also you might have somebody that has a business background or has just taken it upon themselves to learn because it's very easy to find information and to learn today and to take classes, and that's another conversation. But you can figure it out. And so even if you're not like shocker, right, newsflash, even if you're not rich, you might be smart and you might be able to like be trusted to invest your money how you choose. So I think it's ridiculous that net worth has correlated with ability to invest wisely. It makes me very mad. And I don't get mad.
Right. So you're now doing work with Collaborative Fund, which is, if people aren't familiar with it, it's one of the most interesting venture capital funds that's out there. I mean, they are investing in all kinds of interesting fields that maybe some other venture capital firms are not as comfortable with or as into. Can you talk to us a little bit about why Collaborative Fund is different, how they're different
Sure.
to people who aren't familiar?
Sure. So Collaborative invests early stage in companies that are taking advantage of and sort of see two main trends that we believe in and really love. So one is perhaps obviously collaborative consumption, this sharing, you know, the shared economy, sharing economy. So taking advantage of...
How many people are like familiar with this idea of collaborative consumption? This is like one of the big investment theses. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about what that is.
Well, so it's that, and it's basically the other thing is values-based decision-making as consumers. So knowing that people care about the whole story, the holistic sort of company story. So anyway, I'll go back to the other one.
Yeah.
So collaborative consumption, think about instead of just buying, although that has to do with it sometimes too, think about sharing or renting, just, maybe even bartering, trading, swapping, whatever. So for example, maybe it's nice to talk about some of the portfolio companies. So Collaborative is an early investor in Kickstarter, one of the more well-known ones and obvious ones. And if anyone, who is not familiar with Kickstarter, because I can tell you really quickly what that's about. But I think most people are. Okay, so basically, it's a platform where I think the way they define it specifically is it's a place to fund ideas and projects. Now, more and more businesses are starting to go on and they end up getting what amounts to startup capital. But it's actually this way to provide a non-financial return to backers of projects. So basically, like if you now you have another dream. All right, ready? You want to like launch your music career. So you want to make your first, you want to cut your first
CD. I'm a rapper.
CD. You're a rapper. Exactly. I could see that. So you you need like $10,000 to make this first CD or whatever. And whoever, if I back your project for $200, I get a signed copy of the CD or something. If I back it for $500, you write a song about me, right? Like cool, whatever, these non-financial ways of saying thanks. So you're kind of buying like stuff, but it's its own really interesting thing. Anyway, so that's one.
Kickstarter, by the way, in the Bay area at this point. I don't know how many people here from the Bay, but I think every third person in Oakland has run a Kickstarter.
I was running a campaign.
I mean,
right.
I am not kidding. I'm one of them. We did a Kickstarter
for your CD?
A side project. Yeah, no, side project magazine that we do, and it's just crazy. You put your ideas out there, offer these rewards, and next thing you know, you get this check for like $17,000, and you're like,
yeah. Huh. I think what they've done is brilliant. Well, that's part two of the conversation, right? Like what happens after, and there's a lot to be said about sort of people raising sometimes more than they thought, which is all like a great thing, but then having to deal with the fact that, oh, I was just going to build a prototype, but now I basically have, in essence, pre-order, you know, pre-sale of 10,000 units that I didn't expect I'd have to make. But that's another thing.
Yeah, in some cases,
thing.
People have raised like over $1 million.
Yeah. So there's a dozen of them or something that have raised a bunch. So, okay, that's one example. Some others are, they're all on the website, collaborativefund.com, but Gettable, it's like renting anything. Gumroad, it's selling and sharing digital goods. So think eBay, but digital. I mean, that's maybe not the best analogy, but it's so interesting. TaskRabbit, so you can hire people locally to run little tasks for you, like can you pick up my groceries or do my laundry or whatever.
Has anyone tried that, by the way?
It's really cool.
It's another kind of barrier thing. They literally, like you literally like, I don't want to wait in line for this thing. And there's a pool of people who are like, I'll wait in line for you for X amount of
money. $30 or $50, right.
And they just, and it's a marketplace for like ad hoc services. It's
really
absolutely
fun.
Incredible. Yeah. And of course, like only, these things are only possible because it's easy to connect people now. Like the barriers to connecting people are very low. And so people are able to just quickly do this. I mean, another great example, I don't know if it's a portfolio company, Airbnb.
No, but... Right on.
Which is fascinating.
Exactly
we just decided to do
about.
It. There's a cottage out behind our house, and we got a hold of it, and now we're renting it out. And it's just...
Meaning
it's
like night to night, like as if it's a hotel, not the traditional stay here for a week or like for the year, but I'm in town for the night and need...
And it's just remarkably easy. I mean, you take photos, put it up, and next thing you know, you're starting to get inquiries from people who want to stay there, and it looks like, you know, it's an extra $1,000 a month, it looks like for us, which is like, you know, not a ton of money. You're not going to live on it, but it also really... It's starting to change the market dynamics in places like San Francisco where lots of people are doing it because people are willing to pay more for rent knowing they can rent out some of the place or rent it out occasionally. And so actually there's been some analysis done where people blame a big part of the San Francisco rent crisis, which it really is right. at this point, on the ability to essentially commodify a part of your thing and sell it, a part of your own house.
So there we did show versus tell. Those are some of the companies that I think illustrate that concept.
That's cool. Yeah. What other sort of like big theses are you interested in out there? Just the stuff that like strikes you as an area where many companies could flower.
Okay. I think, gosh, that's a really good question. That's a big question. Well, on the other value of the collaborative looks at, I do think more and more people, and I was speaking with someone just outside about this before the session. I think people more and more want to know the whole story of a company. They want to know where their money is going. They want to be able to see and track more and more. Now, I think there's a point at which this is going to be, there'll be a saturation point where people are like, I just need to buy this thing and I don't necessarily need the whole story of like the person that made it. But I believe that more and more that information, people demand that it's accessible and that it exists and that companies actually know what they know the answers to those questions. I think that's an interesting part of the story. I think, I think there's just a blending of so many formally separated sort of spaces. I mean, it's not, for example, Kiva was nonprofit. Kiva is a 501c3, Profounder was for profit. I think more and more it's not going to be about, it's a tax code, not a religion. It's not going to be about, oh, are you this? Are you this? And therefore, if you are for profit, then the culture is this and you're doing these kinds of, you're thinking in this way. Or if you're a nonprofit, then this is your culture. And you know, you're not necessarily applying business principles. I think there's a big blend. This has been going on. This has been coming for a while, but I feel like more and more and more, you're just going to see people figuring out and maybe piecing together the tools and the little bits of structure here and here that they need to get the job done in the world, to like do the thing that they want to do in the world. So sometimes that'll require mechanisms and structures that we are used to, but sometimes it might just be like, for example, I think I talked about Kiva sort of being this thing that was unregulated and like the SEC and others didn't know what to do with, like, what's this weird 0% loan? And similarly, I think with Kickstarter, it's like, what is that? Is that a purchase? Is it a donation? It's not tax deductible. What is that? I'm just like, my money goes in. I get to be part of this experience. You mail me CD. Like, what just happened? So right, I think more right, and more right, they'll right, just, right. People will break out of these old paradigms of this is a purchase or this is a membership or this is a, you know. So it's hard to really right, say as right. a trend, but blurring of things, blurring, right. I guess, or even just breaking out of, erasing some of those old boundaries.
Are you still as interested in sort of unconventional development programs? I mean, that's not that Kiva is just an unconventional, but I mean, are you still interested in the developing world and in working there and in bringing?
I am. This is always a tough one for me because being a mom, having a family, you know, I don't get to, I think one year, a few years before my kids arrived, I was on the road 10 and a half out of 12 months. And so that was fun. And that was its own season. And I felt more like I knew it was going on. I had fresh stories and fresh interactions. And I don't get to do that as much right now. And so everything comes down to specifics. So it's fine to be interested in the rest of the world and international development, but to be immersed is a whole other thing. And I feel like to be really, truly useful and innovative and on the cutting edge, you need that freshness a lot. So I'm trying to figure that out myself, like how to balance when the kids are ready to travel to Africa and everywhere with me. Luckily, I have a very supportive husband too who's into that. So we're trying to figure out what that looks like over the coming years. That's one thing that truthfully I've missed, personally I've missed over the last, say, 4 years. Not as much contact.
It's interesting. We were talking yesterday about a lot of these issues. Work-life balance has become a big thing for The Atlantic. We're actually, in fact, launching a separate channel dedicated to some of these issues coming up very, very soon. And it's interesting to think about on my side. As, you know, I feel like I know a lot of men who are increasingly involved in the raising of their children. And you told me an interesting story earlier about a group that you encountered, and it seemed like sort of worth sharing.
Okay, thank you for giving me the space to do this, and I won't take like 20 minutes, but I have to tell you, I'll do more like 30-second to 2-minute window. Here we go. So I was at a professional gathering, like a high level, like I felt very honored to be recently invited into this group, gathering of folks all in the same stage of life, pretty much 30s to 40s, all at this relatively the same level of success in their careers, pretty well divided between men and women. And I was chatting with one guy there, and he was saying how he not only loves, obviously, the like obvious benefits of these professional events is we all get together and get to meet with world leaders and all this stuff. But he really loves the community that he's made there with other guys and with dads. They have this like dads group that they start, that they started. And so they meet every morning during some of these conferences as a dads group. And I've not ever told this story publicly, so I don't know. I got to tell it carefully and concisely. But basically, I made a joke like, oh, that sounds so awesome. Your dad's group sounds so great. Can I like crash it? Or do I have to go to the mom's group? And like, what's that about? Assuming then he was going to tell me about the mom's group. And he was like, oh, well, there isn't a mom's group. I was like, why? He was like, well, a lot of the women, you know, haven't pursued that. And I was like, whoa, so that's interesting. So this is a group of like peers. The men have happy families, sensibly, right? And kids, and the women have somehow either chosen or whatever. Maybe it is choice, but the fact that contrast was so striking, there wasn't a mom's group. And he actually was like, you know, and I wouldn't bring it up right away, like, it's kind of an issue. It broke my heart that seemed to be the choice. I have one other little bit on this, I would just say that I feel like we talk a lot about providing all this opportunity for women, and that is absolutely a must. I mean, we have to do that. We have to have organizations that structure family and that allow people to have flexibility. And there's kind of the list that we all might be able to recite, that it's just a matter of like companies implementing this and really honoring that. But I think also in my in my sort of community and my observation of again peers, men kind of going through this as well, there's not always the space for men to step back and to do that same thing and to plug in with their families. And so I think it's a challenge for both. And it's not just about women, men. There's all sorts of there are non-traditional families of all different shapes and sizes. But the idea that having children in the mix has to slow down mostly a woman's career, that was such a striking story to me.
Do you see this? I mean, when you were telling me about it earlier, I was thinking, like, this seems like an area so rife for innovation, particularly around, like, the flexibility of the labor market.
Yeah.
I mean, it really just, it just seems like so many people are dealing with this issue, men and women, but I think it obviously falls disproportionately on women. We've had so much, such a reaction to our cover story, Women Can't Have It All.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, and a lot of the reaction was like, awesome. Well, neither can men. And it started to feel like this is like an emergent area where the labor market might get disrupted just for companies that can provide
right.
a more flexible working environment.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's true. It's exciting. You can look at it in an optimistic
way. Yeah, if you put your like entrepreneur hat, yeah. like what would you do?
Well,
like,
actually, one of the things I can't really share a lot yet, but that one of the ideas that I've been talking to some wonderful co-founders with is to sort of, I can't say it. Sorry. But yeah, no, it's basically, I think there are a lot of ways to help companies get there.
Huh, that's interesting. On this same score of kind of the social and entrepreneurship, like these two things together, having social goals, I mean, how do you think that has really evolved both, you know, in your own career and also just sort of more broadly? I mean, you were in one of the kind of defining social ventures at its inception. If you were, you know, starting again now, if you were going to like start Kiva again, like what would you do differently? And like how would you?
I don't know. Okay, so I'm laughing because I speak a lot to college students and to like aspiring entrepreneurs, and I mean I just want to give them all hugs. But I often get folks coming up to me at the end of a talk saying, I want to be an entrepreneur, and I'm like, that is great. What do you care? What do you want to do? I don't know. I just want to be an entrepreneur. And I feel like it's like somebody saying, like, I am going to be an Olympic athlete. What's your sport? I don't know. I just want to do
Olympics.
It. Like,
right. Yeah, right.
I'm getting a medal someday. It's going to be great. So I feel like the thing that we need to sort of maybe also take a step back and calm down about is like being an entrepreneur. It's more like a how you do your life and how you make choices and that sort of thing. I think you need to talk about the what and be sure, you know, dwell in and study and spend time on not dreaming about being an entrepreneur or a social entrepreneur or whatever, which is all fine, but really dig into the details of what you care about. Because otherwise, you know, you get, it always comes back to specifics. Like, what's the field that you love? What are the insights that only you can make once you're immersed and are spending time with the people that you want to serve day after day after day after day and are observing them firsthand? So I don't know. So I think that's something that I see a lot.
Right, that now there's like a defined category that you can do. Like,
right, and it sounds like what's not to love? I want to be a social entrepreneur. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
But I never thought about that. I don't know. I feel like you kind of have to work back your way into it and just do something that you love. And perhaps, yes, study principles of entrepreneurship. Study, you know, see other case studies, see other people's stories. So when you come to those inflection points, those big decisions you have to make, you know what it might feel like to take a bolder risk or whatever.
Right.
And to even within a large organization, or you can be an entrepreneur. You can live an entrepreneurial life and live in a creative sort of regenerative, constantly iterative sort of way in your career, no matter what the structure.
Yeah. It's funny. You see the same thing in tech entrepreneurship too, that there's like an increasing amount of
people. Well, they're not different.
It's people. Right. Right. Yeah. Who just go for the entrepreneur label without an actual idea behind it.
Right. And they're good principles. Some people do see it as like a religion and it is. It's a way that you can live, but there's so many things to do. It's a set of tools, a set of kind of a mindset.
Let's open it up for questions. We have about 15 minutes left.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation. I'd like to ask you, Kiva is such an interesting structure. The Jobs Act is such an interesting piece of legislation. But if you look at the history of financial legislation, unconventional financing structures have been the source of enormous amounts of consumer fraud. You see this in Eastern Europe when they first opened up. The Harvard Fund in the Czech Republic, the MMM Fund in Russia was just a way in which ordinary people lost their entire savings and then undermined the public trust in the financial sector. Then you look at Madoff. And even the SEC couldn't, the Securities and Exchange Commission didn't stop Madoff, even though there were other hedge fund traders who said, we cannot match their performance. We think something strange is going on. So my question to you, since you were a supporter of the Jobs Act, how do you think, what measures will be in place to protect consumers that they don't become subject to fraud?
Sure. It's a good question. So what I got out of my, pre-Jobs Act for a minute, what I got out of trying to understand how to navigate private offerings of securities is that, look, there is an assumption that when you know the person well enough, when it's friends and family and it's private, not public, you're going to know enough to recognize each other's sort of financial situation and you're not going to sort of screw each other over, for lack of a better way to say it. So I think that that makes sense. The spirit of the laws do make sense to a certain degree. What the Jobs Act enables, I think, is sort of the best of so many worlds. So there is still a very high level of information disclosure. I mean, even just for raising, whether you're raising 100,000 or forget exactly all the benchmarks, but regardless, if an entrepreneur is raising even $100,000, which is relatively a small amount, there has to be an accountant sort of verifying financial information. If it's more than that, I think I'm getting this right. There's also an auditor that has to verify. So there's a lot of checking on sort of the numbers for each entrepreneur, for each raise that happens. All of the raises have to go through a qualified and registered crowdfunding portal. When I hear a statement like, you know, everyday people lost their whole savings. I mean, if your income is under $100,000 through the Jobs Act, you can only invest $2,000 max through this exemption. And if it's over that, I think it's 10% of your income. So there are still limitations, whether they're right or wrong. They do exist so that people can't lose their whole savings on, you know, maybe a project that out of the best intentions doesn't go well, or out of the worst intentions doesn't go well. But I feel like there's only so much you can do in terms of building that into law. But then what I really get even more excited about is the spirit of transparent, the spirit and sort of the culture of transparent, values-based communities that are able to regulate themselves. And I think we've seen this happen successfully in other sort of ventures and on other platforms. And I think as everything continues to get more and more connected, you know, people will know if you do something in a malicious way to, you know, get all your friends' money and then head for the hills. Like that, people will know about that. So you can't stop people from behaving badly completely, but you certainly can make sure that their reputation is transparent and that everything that's going on is sort of tracked and measured that way. Does that make sense? So it's not flawless, but I think there are more and more checks and values that are kind of baked into what the Jobs Act will enable.
Thank you. You mentioned collaborative consumption and crowdfunding in the context of supporting the Corner Bakery and Alex's new rap career. Can you also comment a little bit about the applicability to civic engagement and the Corner Library or school?
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the most interesting examples, I think, is the idea, you know, we've had for a long time, like laundromats and libraries and things where a larger institution has provided that structure and the assets, right? With like, let's take the library. What does that look like now when it could be peer-to-peer? What does a library look like when it's not just a one-sided, you know, many to one, but it's many to many? With civic engagement, I mean, I guess I don't want to just start off another list of examples, and I'm trying to keep my answer short. But yeah, I'm not sure else to add to that answer. I think the library example sort of illustrates the potential for that. But are you interested in a particular aspect of civic engagement with this principle? I mean, I guess I want to make sure I understand your question fully.
Whether it's for funding parks or libraries or schools or a new sports complex or other civic engagement kind of issues.
Yeah.
The bond, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I also, one other answer is that there are platforms that are developed, and the name is escaping me, unfortunately, but that allows schools to help fund small things.
Donors Choose is one of
Donors
them.
Donors Choose, yeah,
awesome.
Exactly.
Awesome.
So, you know, at my old middle school, they didn't have sinks in the art room, and so they could go on there and get, you know, raise the $1,000 they needed to build mobile sinks, right? And so there's certainly a possibility. I mean, I think the hard thing with all these engagement platforms and kind of the miracle of things like Kiva and Kickstarter and all these things is that people want to go to them and use them, right? Because it always seems, conceptually, it's so easy to come up with these things, but to get the user experience such that people meaningfully connect and go back to the site and give money, I mean, that is like the secret sauce that probably is like part luck, part skill, and part timing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think maybe two interesting principles that get elevated with these new tools and platforms are, one, people can sort of in advance really proactively speak up about what they do want to see happen. It's not just, you know, waiting for government policy to line up with what they think is important and then, oh, now I'm going to go support that. So they can do that. And also the idea of, I mean, this kind of classic problem of ownership of a civic space or a public space, it gets really specific. You can actually see the people who have demonstrated their either support of it or their interest or their participation by spending time there, I mean, checking in, whatever it is. You can actually see who's really using the public space or something else. I feel like everything like related to what you just brought up gets so much more robust with some of these tools.
Other questions? We have time for a couple more? Sure.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could comment a bit more on this whole concept of balance between work and family life. From firsthand experience, I feel, having three young children myself, that I am able to work because of technology. Were it not for my iPhone and my iPad, where I can be sitting at a kid's soccer game and at the same time responding to emails or on the phone, I don't think I would be able to, you know, pursue my career. And I'm just wondering what you've found out there in terms of resources from the technology front, mm-hmm. and what kind of movements you might see, like with entrepreneurship in that regard, in terms of assisting women as they pursue their career goals.
So I guess in terms of technology, I find that a little bit hard to answer only because it depends, I think, on every person's job. And I sometimes think you don't need that much technology to stay really connected. If you are on email, if you have a smartphone, you can be present. I get more concerned about this idea of being alone together. I'm blanking on her name.
Turkle. Sherry Turkle.
This book like haunts me because it's very easy to be in the same room with your kids, like watching them play, but your eyes and your attention are over here. I have more like emotionally, I get worried about that because I don't think technology is the problem in my experience. I think it's pretty easy to be connected and to seem connected when you're doing other things and when you're with your family. If anything, I guess there's just questions for me around boundaries and when to just turn the thing off and put it in another room and when to be fully present or when to be able to say, look, this is better than being fully removed in an office. So for me to be here, but have to check email while I'm here with you is, I mean, I'm mostly speaking to myself. My kids have their fine other way. So it's more about my own issues, my own sort of desire to experience and be present as a mom during different times, during the day, during the week, et cetera.
I think at the macro level too, you know, people like to talk about how when electricity first came around, right, people continue to build factories the same way that they did, but they just put electric motors where previously there would have been steam engines, steam power. And so it took reconfiguring the entire factory in order to unleash a lot of the productivity that electricity could bring. And I sometimes think about these communications technologies that's kind of what's going to happen. Like, we still work in fundamentally the same way. Most people still go to the office. Although in San Diego, it feels like that's actually less true than in other places. But in many places in the country, right, people still go to the office. They still do the work there. And it's not... there's not that fluid flexibility that you could see people deploying as like the primary way that people work for companies.
Yeah, and I don't know. I can't really speak specifically to the startups that I'm referencing here, but there are a handful that I'm keeping an eye on and some friends are working on that I think will be wonderful, beautiful resources that sort of bring together a lot of concepts around like co-working and shared space. And I mean, things are so isolated, I think, in our culture. I live in LA. My family and I were in New York for the year, and in both places, it's strange because you're so in the mix and you're so among everyone as soon as you walk out the door in New York. In LA, you're in a car, but it's easy to just feel removed and alone, especially as a new parent. I think if there were more ways and safe. Literally safe and kind of emotionally to spaces to be out and about and be doing these things together, to have your kids and be sort of working or connected otherwise. Cafes kind of work, but there need to be new spaces, like physical spaces, yeah, to do this, so that it's not just about being hidden up in your home in the hills or in an apartment complex tweeting or something. I think like actual human contact with people other than your kids while you're working would be a good thing too. So I'm excited to see that develop in the world.
That's great. All right, I think that's all we have time for. Jessica, Jackie.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.